Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into application security. Today, I've brought in John Anthony DeBoer. JA is previously a software engineer who has then moved into being a product security lead for Transmax, which is one of the companies that people don't know about, but does something really important. They're basically managing the flow of traffic using traffic lights around the country. And JA is in charge of managing the security of those products, right? So I really like JA because he brings a lot of rigor from 10 to 20 years of electrical engineering and software engineering, and then taking that approach into cybersecurity. I know that our conversations are quite focused on the nitty-gritty, so like SLSA, so like, you know, SLSA reviews, or we're going to get the DevOps machine, or I would say more broadly, the software engineering machine. How do we go about defining, creating features, and then making sure that there's a definition of done, and we have the right checks and balances throughout the SDLC. So there's a lot of like going really high as well as going quite deep. And I think you'll appreciate all the different perspectives he brings from his like 20 years of SWE before moving into product security. So I guess like probably the funniest thing from this episode is those 20 years he had in SWE, he was always terrified of like computer hackers and all of the AppSec people and so on, because he's like, I don't understand how someone could be a savant and just be super awesome at all this hacking and stuff. They have to really, really deeply technically understand stuff. But often when you pull back the curtain, it's a little bit of a different story, right? So so if you want to learn more about that experience, tune in. I think you'll love this episode. We're here today, everybody, with John Anthony DeBoer, who is the product security lead at Transmax. How are you doing today, mate?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Cole. Super psyched to be here. So first time on a podcast. Very happy.
I try to get a lot of people who haven't had given it a go yet. And it's just so fun to sit down and have a conversation about something that you're really excited and passionate about, right?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it.
Yep. So I thought it would be good for my guests to understand a bit about your background and history and how you ended up becoming a product security lead, because at least I think you started just doing software engineering and mobile software development for a long time, right? Is that where you began?
Yeah. So I'm definitely heavy on the engineering side, or heavier on the engineering side than security. I came to security after what I would say is a whole career in software engineering. And I've really valued the way I started. I started at an electrical engineering company when I was still a late teenager, just doing their IT support for fun. And I stayed with them the whole way through uni. So I worked with them and grew with them. And the value that I got out of that was the breadth of exposure across technology stacks. So this company worked at the PLC level. So they were writing, you know, it's almost like assembly logic, right? And circuit logic for electronics. And then they would layer up with the management info systems on top of that. And then we would layer up again with, you know, remote PDA type software interacting with those systems and whatever. And I just really found that the breadth of software that they were working in was really good in my formative years in the career. So I stayed with them for many years and then went over to China for a little while and worked for an offshore development center over there as kind of the English speaking conduit between the Chinese workforce and their Western customer base. And again, the breadth of software that was being developed and delivered by those teams was pretty interesting. And then started with Telstra after that and stayed there for about 17 years all up. And of course, within Telstra, again, you know, it's such a large organization, and it's so intrinsic to digital society for Australia that played roles in terms of, you know, backend development of APIs, distributed systems, electronic couch potato systems, front end, you know, AFL.com.au, web video player was one of those interesting projects, became a SME for video management, moved over to mobiles, you know, just played a whole bunch of different roles. And the breadth of experience is what I really valued across all of the roles that I've had in engineering. But, you know, got to the point where I thought, okay, well, what's next? You know, I've worn many different hats, led different teams, different tech stacks. And something that really started to appeal to me a little while back was cybersecurity. So it's one thing as a maker. So I used to consider myself a craftsperson of software. You flow between the different stacks and you learn the different syntax, but essentially you're a craftsperson for automations, right? And it used to just fascinate me that people could get software that was designed to do a thing and they could get it to do completely different things in a world that I thought was very on and off, one and zero, like very, very hard yes or no answers, right? And so I started getting into that and started learning about how software could be made to do interesting things.
And then after that, you've just been staying in the product security, application security area for like last, how many years would you say, 4 or 5, 6 years?
6 or 7, I think, the latest 6 or 7 years. It's been about how do we secure the machines that we build and then how do we secure the machine that builds the machine? So definitely security from a DevOps perspective, DevSecOps, but also with an interest in penetration testing and, you know, some of those sort of red activities as well.
Yeah, you gotta have an interest in how to break stuff as well. Like for me, I find that the best AppSec people come from software engineering backgrounds almost always, but you'll also probably laugh at me and I'll say political staffer / diplomat. Simply because
victims of those.
Well, they come out of it and they're like, look, you know what, I'm sick of dealing with international relations and like people that suck and like constituents and all of that jazz. So I'm going to go join a big enterprise. I'm going to deal with like different political parties internally and constituents who don't want to do software like stuff and convince them about my messaging and narratives and marketing. So, you know, those kind of groups or the software engineers who say, oh, cool, so this isn't working. I may as well build a fix to solve the problem. Fixed now. Those are the two types of groups I find do really, really well in the AppSec sphere. So I feel like I'm a little bit of a mix of both. Not that I campaign as a poly, but I think that I've done enough public speaking to be able to have people think I was one. So
I do think you're bang on in that point around diplomacy. So one of the observations that I would make over time is that software engineering and the security team that are at least ostensibly tasked with safing software engineering, they come from very different worlds. And so the diplomacy involved in trying to align those or, you know, herd those cats to coordinate so that they're working toward a common goal that is feasible and achievable and meaningful to both groups, I don't think that should be understated. So your point about political staffers seeing a different way to use their skills and experience, resonates with me.
Yeah, I just don't want to only get people from the same background. And I find it overwhelmingly, we have so many breakers who want to move into AppSec. And then when I say, I know that you got an OSCP and you're CREST certified and you're good at hacking and all of that jazz, but like, how do you fix the problem? And often they'll be like, oh, SQL injection, it's easy. Just use parameterized queries. Like, great. And you're like, oh, awesome. We'll just tell them to not use the ORM that they're using at the moment, right? Because they don't actually write direct SQL at this point. They're using it. So how is this even occurring if I've got an ORM in the first place? And they're like, boom, don't know, don't understand this. And that's why I think that SWE moving into AppSec makes a lot of sense, because then they can look at it and say, oh, well, I know SQL alchemy. This is how we made this mistake, right? We used raw.sql here. So let's fix that up. But everywhere else, the ORM takes care of it. But a lot of pen testers will be like, duh, parameterized queries. Like, clearly, that's the advice that's been around for a long time. You developers are dumb.
100%. And I would say that I've practically experienced kind of the attitudes that you were just sort of describing loosely. One of the things that I like to ask if I'm engaging a vendor, particularly for a pen test or any artifact, it could be a lunch and learn, it could be an assessment, right? Just as important as identifying the control gaps is the recommendation or the advice to the consumer of that report or assessment on what to do about it. So what does good look like? And I think, yeah, that's very much a front and center thing. I have been in that world where you would receive a pen test report and there would be an issue and you'd say, okay, well, what do I do about that? And it's just crickets, right? So this is, again, you know, security and software engineering working together to solve the problem.
I know that's something that you're quite a big advocate of, is that instead of us chucking things over the fence, we need to kind of collaborate a lot more. But I also think that you have a lot of, as someone who's done a lot of software engineering in the past, you think that there's a lot more power in line one, effectively managing these risks in advance. What do we do to help software engineers be more accountable and actually proactively deal with more of these issues rather than us having to have AppSec teams or security professionals tell them to solve stuff?
Well, I mean, first and foremost for me, is I believe in securing the machine that builds the machine. And by that, I mean the SDLC. Now, inclusive with that will be incentives on solving problems that you become aware of, right? So you become aware of a thing. Usually it's a tool injecting into a process that raises alerts of potentially significant things you might need to look at. But if incentives on those software engineering teams are not aligned with security's incentives, then what you will see is things will be risk accept or simply ignored, right? And that's not to disparage any one team. That's an organizational failure. So the organization needs to ensure alignment of incentives. So if you're telling software engineering teams effectively, the number one priority for you is business delivery, feature delivery, bug fix for features, you know, functional features. And that is the only thing that you're actually measured on in reality beyond goodwill and nice statements. Then of course, those teams, especially resource where resource pressure is concerned, are going to focus on hitting the things they're being marked on. And that is that's the entire chain. You know, this is Scrum Masters and product owners and whatever. If they're being marked only on, you know, business outcomes, and those business outcomes are primarily dealing with feature delivery and you know, hitting delivery milestones, they will do that. The security team might be tasked with changing the game. So you've got to demonstrate a 5% improvement in, you know, something. It might be a reduction in vulnerabilities that you're aware of or whatever. And so you're clashing. Because you're saying, well, we need to be moving this needle, but they're saying, but I've got to get delivery out, and so you won't hit your mark. So I think first and foremost, you've got to have aligned incentives and aligned objectives for the organization, so that you're not reaching that conflict. The second thing I would say is there's this great talk. It's a Harvard Business School talk that you can just find on YouTube. It's called "A Plan Is Not a Strategy." And in security, I think we've been particularly guilty of this, right? Basically, from a separation of concerns between software engineering and security, is we'll come up with plans that we can execute on. They're in our control. We can budget for it to improve security. So that's the high level task. And it might be that we will buy a tool and we will integrate it. Happy days. But if we don't have the right strategy behind that plan, or that planning activity, series of plans, then there's no real guarantee that we're going to be doing anything in advance. So while I would call on security as well to say, well, we might have these great ideas on how we can improve things, but what we need is a coherent strategy to make sure that everyone agrees that we're taking the right approach, that we're putting together plans that support delivery of that strategy and don't contradict other people's plans, right? And so, yeah, there's a lot of coordination that I think needs to occur. It's not just pure signals. It's about incentives and organizational momentum in the right direction.
Yeah. So unpacking that, there's two things I really want to jump out at is, firstly, have you heard of Goodhart's Law? I think it's Goddard's Law.
I don't think so.
So it's a measure that becomes a target ceases to be a good measure. And the idea is that, just to give you a simple example from Australia, is we have this constantly increasing tax rate on cigarettes, right? And over the last couple of years, it's been really good. And now we've hit the point where the tax is too punitive, that people are actually committing crimes instead of paying the tax. And it's actually leading to a higher prevalence of smoking, which is not the intended outcome. The intended outcome is to wean people off smoking. So the politicians are kind of looking at that saying, okay, well, we know that maybe that's the terminal point now, rather than keep increasing at that point. And we see the same with how people use like metrics for software security a lot of the time as well. It's why I'm not really a fan of things like zero criticals or like, you know, mean time to resolution and so on, because one, like if you got zero criticals, the easiest way is to just like mark everything as a false positive, or dash exclude the files that have problems in them, or put comments in there. Or I think my favorite I saw in a manual code review once was someone changed all the instances of password to password, and then the static analysis tool was like, oh, well, I guess that's not a hard-coded credential. And it's like, great, okay, it is. I guess it's not. So, but obviously, to my very good eyes, I could still tell that it is clearly a password. And so we can't trust the output of these tools. But also, it goes back to those incentives, right? So when we say that we have a KPI, and the KPI is that we're not allowed to be having this many vulnerabilities being introduced into production, If we're setting that as the KPI, then there's many ways to achieve it. Some of those ways are in line with what we intend, and other ways will achieve the KPI, but not necessarily do what we want them to do. Like another example, like to go outside of AppSec entirely, is Sentinels, right? you might say you want people to do 100 calls a week. Yeah, they can make 100 calls a week. That doesn't mean they need to talk to anybody or actually lead to any sales outcomes. You just pick up the phone and randomly dial people. I don't know if that's ever going to be particularly helpful, but or helpful grow your business or whatever, but at least you're making those 100 calls a week, right? So, and that's why a lot of these businesses have moved back to the OKR rather than KPIs, because you can then ask them, well, you've got these key results, you have an objective, and if what you're doing is not in line with the objective, then you're clearly not doing the right thing. And so I've seen that a lot in the AppSec sphere. The other thing was about strategy. So there's a book have you read Good Strategy, Bad Strategy before? So can't remember the author's name, but one of the things he says is that basically everyone sucks at strategy, and they all say wishy-washy things like vision, mission. We're going to be the best. Our strategy is make more money, which is not particularly helpful. And he always brings it back to, you need to spend a lot of time diagnosing what the real problem is at a high enough level that you can actually get as many different perspectives and views before you actually ever go ahead and say, well, now that we've got a diagnosis of what we need to solve, we'll create an operational plan to work to solve those next with some guiding principles if the plan doesn't go to as we think. But in my experience, like when cybersecurity tends to make strategies, it's usually in the context of cybersecurity, not in the context of the business. And that means that your software engineering teams are excluded from the conversation, and then you end up with two different types of like business unit strategies butting heads against each other constantly, both of them achieving their goals but also failing the business overall. So
I would completely agree with that, right? So it's the silo nature of teams, and once again, we need to have software engineering and the security teams working together and singing from the same songbook. I do like your I think it was the Goddard's law. It resonates with me. There was this old Register article or something where they talked about the green bar of Shangri-La, right?
Okay.
Are you familiar with that?
No, I would love to. Tell me more. Right? Is this a bar that you like, you drink at? Because I'd be keen for it.
No. But, you know, back in the, I think, mid-2000s, the idea of your IDE, and you'd run your unit tests, and it would be red if anything failed, and it would be green if everything passed. And so the green bar of Shangri-La is that green bar, or your test pass. And of course, what you mentioned about commenting out troublesome files and things, you know, if you've got this metric, it's 80% coverage of unit testing, right? Of all code, just 80% coverage. But you're actually pulling in more open source framework data that has, you know, so many lines of code that it's unwieldy, right? To have enough unit tests to cover that. So what you end up doing is just to get these contrived tests to get that 80%, you know, green bar of Shangri-La, or you just comment out all your troublesome stuff. And that might extend to things like, oh, what about my, you know, symmetric crypto? I'm not really sure what I'm doing there. So I'll just comment that excluded from the calculation. And suddenly we're not even testing it, right? So, and it comes down to who's even looking, right?
I remember assert true, true.
Yeah. So no, it's really interesting. But the point about aligned strategies, so I think that is a key message that I'd like to take away from this podcast, from this experience is, you know, you made the point about, you know, I've got a strategy over here in Team X, and we've got plans to execute on that strategy, and we've got metrics to demonstrate our success in achieving that plan, and same in Team Y, but overall for the organization, we're not actually changing the game unless we coordinate.
Yeah. And I know that a lot of AppSec teams tend to look in terms of coverage and capability, which means that they've completely missed the whole point of diagnosing what their actual problems that they need to solve for are. Because like maybe if you're saying, oh, we need a WAF, why do we need a WAF? Do we actually need a WAF, or do we need a SCA tool? Do we need dev training? Well, what's the problem that we're trying to resolve using these kind of things? And then you could probably go off a few rungs and say, oh, okay. So the problem is that our velocity is like all of our customers require us to be providing assurance. Otherwise, they won't do business with us. But the way that we're doing assurance is we're using third-party penetration testers, and they're just booked out for 6 months in advance. So we've got no real way to just get those conversations happening and remove some blockers from the sales conversation. So what do we need to do? Invest in something that can give customers a level of assurance in a very quick time frame. And that's a very different one from saying we're missing SAST, we're missing DAST, we're missing like WAF, which is most AppSec people I speak with that start there and go like, yep, here are my favorite products. Let's get them going.
Yeah, I know this tool. I know how it works. I know how to integrate it. We should do this thing, right? Yeah.
I love Fortify. I see Fortify everywhere. It's my favorite. So,
but for me, right? So I look at the current industry trend of, you know, saying, okay, well, now we've got all these things. We executed on all these plans. We were successful in getting them integrated, and we're now seeing signals. We're still not really meaningfully changing the game. We need another tool now. We've got a layer on top of that. We've got to have automatic inspection of you know, the SDLC, the source code, the output of these tools, so that we can give the teams the signal that they need to focus on instead of all these other signals we're generating, right? And I do think, yeah, step back a little bit. Think about your strategy, why it is that you're going to win as an organization, and you're going to win safely and secure enough sort of way. Work with security, work with those teams and say, okay, instead of focusing on that green bar of Shangri-La metric, what's something I can do? Okay, are the primary, like the crown jewel source code projects, are they known? Do we have an asset inventory of the highest priority things that everyone agrees on? Okay, great. Do we have single source of capability in the SDLC, so that we're simplifying and reducing complexity, because you can't secure infinite complexity, right? Do we have teams that are enabling and disabling signals? Would we know about it? What can we do to become aware of, you know, someone turning off secret push protection in GitLab or something like that? So how do we know that that sort of thing is occurring? Or how do we know that the engineering teams are on board and engaged and complying with our policies and expectations, right? And if we get those behavioral aspects right, then security can start to have a focal point and work with software engineering to say, okay, now that we've got this single source of capability for a container registry, right? This is the one we use for our organization. We can start to inject security controls in there, and we'll get that force multiplier effect outcome, because all the images we manage will be subjected to the same security protections. And we'll start to reduce our OPEX burden, and we'll start to reduce other complexities down the way. So,
and that's why I really like taking something that is like quite valuable for software engineering to do in and of itself, but then has, like, as a side effect, good security benefits. And then, because when you aim for that, it's actually, you know, that, like, I always go to AppSec people and say the cyber budget is like 1% of the engineering budget, and AppSec within cyber is like another 1%, right? So why don't you go and talk to the engineering leaders and say, so one of the things that you're really getting stuck on is that you just spend heaps of time troubleshooting. Have you considered, like, maybe having environment parity? Because then you won't have bugs that only appear in production. They'll appear in dev and test as well. And then if I spend a lot of time just like having the same kind of infrastructure, the same kind of apps running in dev, test, and prod, then the security benefits is that if you know it's going to be running in dev, it should run in prod. And so that allows you to release software significantly more frequently. And what are the benefits of that? If something goes wrong, you can roll back really quickly. If a system goes offline, you can spin it up really quickly. If you need to introduce a security mechanism, so let's say an API security product, a DAS scanner or whatever, because the release cycle is so fast now, that they're willing to suffer that pain. Whereas if there's a difference between dev, test, and prod, then that means that the DAST tool or the SCA tool or SAS tool that runs in each of these environments will have different outputs and frustrate engineers. Like, there's nothing like an engineer coming back and saying, we've got 20 sneak high findings, and these are all to do with dev dependencies that are only on the Docker container that builds the running production container. So how do we mark those as false positives, right?
Well, they're not false positives. They're true positives. They're just not relevant to the production deployable component. Yeah.
Yeah, true.
So you've got to be able to understand that and articulate that difference. But I think from what I'm hearing, like what you were just describing, it comes down to building trust in your SDLC. So if you can simplify and harden and secure the various components that build this distributed system that is an SDLC, you can start to have assurance that you'll be able to get the release out on time. And security is not the blocker. And if you find a security issue, you'll be able to work it, and you'll be able to either remediate or avoid or whatever it happens to be. And it's not going to block the business unsustainably. Because I think sometimes there's a little bit of hesitance from, say, the business side of the house. Say, well, we've got to hit our contract. You know, the business does not exist to serve security. Security is a servant for the business to help the business succeed. And so if we have to choose between, you know, not being viable because we can't hit our delivery requirements and being secure, that you're usually going to say, well, let's hit our delivery requirements. We'll risk accept for the moment. We'll address it later, right? And so we want to avoid that friction. And so building trust in that machine that builds the machine will help the business sustainably secure, you know, whatever it is that they're building. It's certainly something that appeals to me based on my experience.
So based on your experience, if you were to build a secure SDLC, where would you start? Because everyone I know in application security tends to focus almost always on shifting to the left. But like, obviously there's like, you can go design and then verification and CI, but, and I see that significantly less focus is on what's running in production, even though you can get some really good signals to actually influence the rest of the program. But whereabouts do you think is the best bang for buck for devs and for business productivity?
So it's probably going to differ between greenfields and brownfields. Anything legacy, you know, if you've got a bunch of stock vulnerabilities and you're not mutating that software very often, so there's not much in the flow space, then you're probably going to go IDR, you know, you're going to be focusing in there on there. And again, like if you're starting from scratch, you're probably going to start on the machine, right? You'll start with the flow end of the spectrum, maybe shifting left or at least injecting into that pathway to production. The reality is you have to burn that candle at both ends, right? You need to secure the machine. You need to have visibility in, you know, runtime, but it depends on resourcing and, you know, budget pressures and whatever. Where I would start is build observability. Start from the basics. What are my source code repos that I have to protect? Because if I don't know what I'm protecting and what leads to the runtime, how can I protect it? I won't even know, right? So start with the source code. Then look at the pathway for that source to production. Do we know it? Are there multiple systems in play? Is everything, are all the build steps, you know, scripted and reproducible, right? Is it committed to source control? What about the SDLC itself? Who builds that? Where is it managed? Or how is it managed and mutated, right? And so I'd start with observability. You've got to know what it is you're protecting to be able to have any chance of understanding how well protected it is and who does what in the event of an incident and whatever. But thereafter, it becomes a bit of a judgment call, to be honest. So if I'm working on a product, right, as a product security person, if my product is not really in production yet, if we're still in our seed funding days or whatever, then I would be focusing on that flow end of that spectrum. If I've come into a company that's well established and they've been a mature product, then I'd be looking at the stock end of the spectrum, right? But the reality is you've got to do both. And I think you start with understanding what it is that you're protecting. So I'd be looking at observability. I'd also be looking at, okay, what's the culture in the organization from engineering as much as anything, right? And so do we have developers that are engaged? Do we have teams that push back on security? Do we have security teams that understand the product that they are attempting to secure? And so try to look at the culture and the behavioral aspects of how software engineering is actually done in that organization. Because if you've got, say, a great SDLC, but teams are pumped to deliver, and so they take side shortcuts and you get shadow IT and you get this, that, and the other, then all your efforts to focus on securing that machine you know about, potentially useful, potentially not, who knows, right? So you might need to change those behaviors and build a case for, okay, well, we need to not have shadow IT and we need to all consolidate for the good of the organization, right? And psych acceptability, actually, if I can put it in those terms, that I'd have to say is one of the key things to start with in any security campaign for any organization, because you can come up with all manner of justifications for things you want to do and want to restrict usually in security for good reason. But unless the people that are the heart of the organization and the people make decisions about technical dependencies, they make decisions about risk accepting, they make all sorts of decisions, right? About what it is that is possible to observe. If those people aren't on board with where you want to go with security, then they'll find creative ways to just get around it, right? And I think that's probably a truism for a lot of organizations. So the psych acceptability, the observability, the behaviors, where I'd probably start.
Yeah, I think that's why I still think change management is really important and people should spend some time in understanding, like, you know, how do you identify the people who are going to be early adopters, who are like excited about technology? How do you identify the people who are going to be blockers and laggards, and then eventually have different campaigns and approaches? Because, like, you know, evangelizing, being excited, getting hands-on with these people, that's going to be effective. You're going to have to use policies and sticks and make it easy for the other group of people. And right-sizing an AppSec program, it's really challenging from what I've seen. I think a lot of people end up getting stuck, like pigeonholed into a specific style of organization, and then they just see that as how you do an AppSec program. So like I've known many people who've just like gone between different like financial services places, and then the first thing they say is, cool, well, we've got our static analysis tool, commercial variant, not going to look at SemGrep. We're all just going to look at the expensive ones. We've got our like API security product for production. It's always Akamai. Why not? Got to be, because that's what the bank uses for CDN. And then sometimes they end up moving to a small business, like a Eucalyptus, or I'd be loath to call Atlassian a small business, but like, you know, something that's a little bit of a bit different type of organization as far as SDLCs go. And then they're like, how come we're building our own software? Why are we using all these open source tools? Like what are all of these startups, and why do we use any of these instead of like mature brands out there? Right. And so choosing the right things for different types of companies can be quite challenging unless you've actually gone and seen what else exists out there and what use cases you need to solve for. You know, there's a lot of like products that solve very specific problems for very specific verticals, but they collapse when they end up in the enterprise sphere because they don't have all of the things you'd expect, like, oh, I need a SOC 2 Type 2, and it needs to integrate with these 16 products and have Active Directory integrations for SSO. And it needs to also maybe have Google Workspace SSO integrations and SAML-based assertions and auditability for everybody's logs. And then that poor startup will come back and say like, whoa, nah, we're not about that. We just want to secure code, right? And so like choosing these right types of tools, like even like training developers and understanding culture, as a business gets a lot bigger, it's really difficult to say, hey, all you developers, I want you all to be excited and happy and 10 out of 10 devs who are going to do the best job possible and care about security and every other non-functional requirement out there. We know that's unrealistic. You go to a small startup where you have like three or five developers, and they're all like, they're saying like, yes, sir, for the mission, I'll do whatever I can, right? Go to like an enormous bank like Capital One. I don't think they care whatsoever.
Yeah, and I think, you know, separating again from focus on particular tools for organizations, you might find that just the free open source thing that comes packaged up with, you know, your SCM, maybe that's actually sufficient if the intent of the business, if the behaviors and expectations are all aligned. Remember, these are non-tool focused. If everyone's on board with security, you can probably achieve some really great outcomes. And that's before you've spent money on layers of expensive tooling, right? And then the tooling that manages that tooling.
What would you say would be more effective, by the way, is do you need to have a CTO, like a senior level person who's pushing for this? Or is it better to have like within the each of the like feature teams to have the one security champion pushing for it? Because I've seen both approaches be quite effective.
My instinct, based on experience, is that it's actually super important that top-level leadership have absolute buy-in to what you're trying to achieve as a security program or with your security program. And I mean that from engineering and security, there has to be that top-level leader buy-in to say, yes, I support you. It has to be public. But thereafter, we really need to listen. And this is, again, that combination of alignment between software engineering and the security team. We need to actually understand how software engineering is done practically so that the security team can understand which controls are going to be the most effective and least disruptive to enable delivery in a safe sort of way. Because I have seen it as well where, you know, you have a groundswell of support from feature teams, right? And they just can't get the budget and they can't get the prioritization for the work you need to do because we've got delivery commitments and it's all done, you know, 6 months in advance with people that are not related to the actual coalface sort of work, right? But then I've also seen on the other side in the security lens where a control will be proposed and included in a policy or a standard that is practically not possible to comply with. It just simply, it reads well, but there's no way for the team to actually take that and run with it and do something about it, right? And so I do think you need that coming together of teams. You need software engineering. You need that empathy to understand, well, how do you actually do things, right? And how big a change could we realistically make to that organization in terms of how it does things, right? And then figure out which controls are acceptable and will meaningfully do something, you know, with a positive sort of angle on security outcomes. without completely disrupting the engineering teams. We need that alignment, but it has to have top-level leader support.
But I see a lot of CTOs understand and care quite deeply about making sure that the applications that their teams are producing have security built in, or that they get regular pen testing or some level of assurance built into that kind of culture. But what I often see is that a lot of those CTOs also come from a software engineering background, and so they can provide these technical recommendations. Where I think it falls over is when you have, like, you get an organization to a large enough status where you have a chief security officer, a head of security, and most of the time they come from a policy and governance background, a SOC incident response, or even a pen testing background. And so with that kind of approach, they're very rarely going to understand how the SDLC works and why you can't enforce things that make sense within end user compute and infrastructure in the same way to software engineering. Like,
yep.
Ones that I understand that I see a lot, patching. Oh, all patches, like critical patches, need to be deployed in 48 hours. Like, that sounds really great. I wish that the open source maintainers that, you know, have these transitive dependencies would also follow my 48-hour SLAs, but who am I? I don't donate to open source, right? I'm not supporting curl out there, am I? So,
love for sure.
There's still probably heaps of businesses that have like Spring Boot vulnerabilities from even before that. So, like, yeah, you know how it is.
And this is an interesting thing, right? So you kind of have gone on a tangent, at least the way I'm hearing it, into, you know, the domain of the specialist manager versus the generalist manager.
Mm.
And as the organization grows, what we find is that leaders, their accountabilities become much broader than maybe their original skill sets. So maybe I'm a qualified engineer, but now I'm responsible for a 3,000 human organization with many, many, many different teams and playing in different spaces, right? And so there's only so much that leader will be able to be an expert, you know, for across their accountability range. And in fact, I know with a lot of management, it's seen as a bit of a virtue to step outside your comfort zone and go and manage a domain that you are not an expert in and learn how to lead teams in that way. Now, the problem with that, you know, that I've seen is, I say that the specialist manager who intimately understands their domain, they will know perhaps and be able to come up with plans for how to say improve security outcomes for their organization. And they will request the budget to make that happen. So they'll understand the work and need the money to make it happen and the time. The generalist manager might be really great at being given a budget and saying, with this budget, try to do things that move the needle, right? And that may not occur. Once again, you've got a finite budget. You've got a goal that you want to achieve. Craft a plan that you can execute on that satisfies your needs. It may not actually do anything meaningful for the organization. And so you get these two types of leader, right, in big organizations that maybe, you know, on the one hand, the specialist manager's proposals are just unwieldy. The business cannot fund them and execute on them. They're just going to break the business. But on the same token, the generalist manager, who has a limited budget and can work to that sort of requirement, is just simply ineffective, right? Nothing ever changes. And we see that in other organizations. So there's a bit of a balancing act to play there. And I think what you're talking about, that CTO that came from their domain, and that, you know, at a certain size of organization, they can still have that visibility and provide that course correction, you know, and make sure the strategy is in alignment with the business. Yeah, I totally get that point. It's a very difficult thing as you go up in terms of organizational sort of size.
In my experience, when someone is like looking at becoming a leader internally within their organization, they know all the skeletons and they've seen how things have been. But oftentimes, they're not going to be particularly innovative. They're going to be looking at efficiency and effectiveness. Like, I think Jarvis Deming would have said something like, the most effective process is like not doing the work that you don't need to do. Like, and so it doesn't matter. You don't want to do an efficient process if you don't need to do it at all, right?
100%. And shout out to Anita Cunningham from Quality Business Services. One of the best courses I ever did, professional development, was her core operational excellence course. Now, I'm a technical person, but this is more about operational management and leadership. And she introduced me to things like, you know, understanding your ecosystem, you know, input, process, output, like for you, for what you manage, understanding value streams in your processes. So where the pure waste is, where the, you know, regulatory requirements, wasteful, but we have to have it, and where the value is that a customer would pay for, all these sorts of things. It's a great course, and it really opened up my eyes to management of, you know, processes such as, you know, software delivery processes as distinct from the technical components of how, you know, how to write code and how to produce artifacts and whatnot.
Yeah. And look, that's, I think that those courses are super valuable. And when people, like, I always encourage people to just get out of software engineering and AppSec and security and go do anything else, including politics, right? Like, it's, there is nothing better for, like, someone who, like, spends all the day arguing about, is it going to be Arch Linux or is it Mint or is it Ubuntu? And this is the life-defining issue, for them to go to the beach and then just see people get in on the punch-up about, like, you know, whatever. And then they're like, wow, real life is so fundamentally different. Why am I caring about these kind of things? And then they have to take a step back and realize that most of these senior executives are going to be probably more like the beach goers than the people arguing about Arch Linux.
So. Yeah. And there was a really great talk that I remember listening in on. I think it was from the head of partnerships or something at Google a couple of years back. And he started his talk. It was about AI, right? But he started his talk with a nice little graph, considering the audience in the room, of Google queries for AI search terms, AI related. And, you know, the graph started out looking pretty impressive, right? Because it's all this positive reinforcement of your own biases and own interests and whatever. And then he broadened it out to think, you know, things like my car and groceries and whatever. And then it was like cost of living and this sort of thing. And it just really brought home the idea that we're in this little little bubble most of the time as software engineering and software security people. A lot of what we consider to be super important and pressing and whatnot is definitely not the most high priority thing for most of the population. And a lot of the non-expert yet accountable leaders that we end up serving in our organizations. And it's good to be mindful of that and stay humble.
That's it. So for everybody, all of you in my little bubble, I think you should all say thank you to John Anthony for sharing his thoughts in our little AppSec bubble. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, mate.
No, thank you. I really, really enjoyed my very first podcast ever. So I hope it's useful for anyone who's listening in. And if anyone has any queries or concerns or wants to bounce ideas, I'm always happy to bounce ideas off LinkedIn or whatever it is.
That's it. So go ahead, add John Anthony on LinkedIn and say hello. Anyway, that's it for today. We'll see you next episode.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Secured. If you got any feedback at all, feel free to hit us up and let us know. If you'd like to learn more about how Galah Cyber can help keep your business secured, go to galahcyber.com.au. If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage. And I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.